www.ecosystemsolutions.org.
This is Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, here on KEPW, LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at KEPW.org. All right, last week we were supposed to play Keith McHenry, but I did a repeat. The machine here did a repeat of Citizens Climate Lobby, and I don't know, I'm getting mixed things about a carbon tax, but it's one solution, so go to Citizens Climate Lobby for that. Don't forget to check out our news is rockin' newscast lately for local stuff with John Quetzalcoatl Murray. So be sure and check that out. To the Moon and Back just did a great interview here, so she's going to be doing some other great stuff. So I hope you'll tune in. Today, what I did is unfortunately, I increased my carbon footprint, but it was the only way I could go see King Crimson down at the Greek in L.A., and I got a half-hour interview with the producer of King Crimson on Discipline Global Mobile, which is an alternative way to pay musicians fairly for their work. So that's coming up here on an interview with David Singleton. But first I'm going to give you a rant on, I'm not happy with the way the news is reporting the Afghanistan withdrawal, as if, you know, we should stay in a 20-year trillion-dollar war. So that's coming up here on KEPW. Let's get to it. Thanks for listening. Tell your friends. KEPW, LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks, Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. And the opinions on this show are not that of the station or KEPW website or any of that. All right, the show's Talk is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Susti, here on KEPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene, Oregon, Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, also streaming online at kepw.org. Please support independent media. Okay, so news on Afghanistan is grim. You know, the Taliban are taking over, but mostly caused by American foreign economic policy, in my humble opinion. Okay, if that's not clear enough that this is my opinion. All right, so I'm listening, you know, Terry, I have a lot of respect for Terry Gross. It's partly why I do what I do. I'm heavily influenced by her, and some of her style is what I try to do here. And she, I heard the name of her, replacement, like his name escapes me, but they had this guy on that wrote a book on finding Osama bin Laden, and you know, there's a lot of evidence that he probably died on a dialysis machine somewhere, but that's whatever, that may be conspiracy theory. I'm not getting into that. But this guy, you know, he said, for one thing, he said that bin Laden was out of touch with, you know, what was right for Afghanistan. Well, the reason he's out of touch with what is right with Afghanistan is because he basically was a product of the military-industrial complex to justify a unnecessary war with the wrong country. So, of course, he's going to be out of touch because he's basically a boogeyman created by the military-industrial complex, in my opinion. And if you want a history, a primer on the Taliban, I suggest you watch Charlie Wilson's War. We supported, and I'm totally generalizing on this, we supported the Taliban to create a Russian Vietnam in there. And so aside from, you know, no one has ever won a war in Afghanistan, including Genghis Khan, Kublai Khan, Napoleon, and the Soviet Union have all tried to win wars, and it's just no one can do it. It's just not happening over there. So, and you know, they're saying in the news, well, you know, we're trying to stop the exploitation of women, and I've said this before, there's nothing that exploits women like war, women and children. So to justify war to stop exploitation of women is just completely preposterous. And so if you could justify putting a bunch of troops in Afghanistan to save Afghanistan, you would put an international force in there, not a unilateral force like we did. And of course the international community is not in favor of doing that, and we don't even pay our dues to the UN. We owe them, I just looked it up, we owe them somewhere in the range of $1 billion, which of course wouldn't pay for a war. But I mean, theoretically, what you would do is if you were going to put troops on the ground at all, you would put like 10 troops for every one person and shut down the entire country and hold elections would be what you would do. But of course, and what you really should do is put humanitarian aid. So what really set me off was this guy, he pulls out Korea as an example of, well, if we'd have stuck with Afghanistan after 20 years, after a 20 longest war in U.S. history, and spent trillions of dollars, he's saying, well, you know, we should have stuck with it, and they could have been like South Korea. And I'm like screaming at the radio, you got to be freaking kidding me. I mean, we basically, the Korean War lasted 3 years, and then we bombed the bejesus out of, literally dropped, I think the statistic is, dropped more bombs on Korea than we dropped in the entirety of World War II. On Korea on our way out. So, no. I mean, with that logic, I don't know, why don't we firebomb the cities and then drop a couple of nuclear bombs on there and then rebuild the country and turn it into a Philip K. Dickian, William Gibson corporate dystopia dependent on exports, causing a global environmental disaster. Oh, that's right. We did that. And so, you know, instead of making these countries, what we've done is made these countries in a neoliberal, this is a neoliberal concept. We've made these countries dependent on exports so that we have to ship stuff on giant ships across the ocean rather than build, make them ourselves. Instead of making them self-sufficient democracies that we would trade culture with and maybe a few items that you can't grow anywhere else, that you can't produce anywhere else, we would trade those. But you would make them a self-sufficient, and if you want to make them a capitalist self-sufficiency, but instead we use this Cold War rhetoric, and you know you would win the hearts and minds of these people with humanitarian aid. The money that we spent on the Afghan war, we could have had the streets lined with gold, and you would win the hearts and minds of these people instead of, and forget this Cold War anti-communist rhetoric that we use in these countries. Okay, so that's basically it. We've turned these countries, you know, to turn Afghanistan into a South Korea would be turning it into a neoliberal corporate, multinational corporate slave colony, basically, is what this guy's advocating. And it just, I'm just was appalled that this was on, I'm not appalled that it was on NPR, but I was appalled that it was on Terry Gross. Okay, so coming up, what I'm going to do, I'm going to play you a tune here. What this is, and then I have an interview with David Singleton, of the producer of King Crimson. So what this is the song that's impossible. Even Fripp does not play this anymore. The guitar solo in this song is impossible to play. So it's called Fracture, and this is a version. This version from the 70s, from when it first came out, is my favorite version. And what you want to do when you're listening to this, take yourself a bong load. And you want to listen toward the end of the song. The guitar solo is incredible. That's not my favorite part of the song. My favorite part of especially this version, Bill Bruford's known for having the loudest, at this time anyway, he had the loudest snare in rock and roll. And when you listen to this, what I do is what you want to do is get stoned and visualize death pounding on someone's door, maybe not your door, but he's pounding on this door, and that's Bruford's snare sound. He's pounding on the door and just can't get in for whatever reason, and he's flailing around, and that's what I visualize when I listen to this song. Okay, so this is Fracture here on KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio. Thank you. Okay.
I'm really feeling now.
All right, so I think what got me this interview is I asked you, why isn't King Crimson in the Hall of Fame?
No, Oli, that was the least. Well, that was the least exciting of the questions.
Okay.
But I will answer that. So, why is King Crimson not in the Hall of Fame? Two reasons. Firstly, King Crimson has never been asked. That's the simple reason. The more complicated reason is, which is maybe why they've never asked, is that I don't know that King Crimson would accept. Because who would accept? As in, King Crimson is a multi-headed beast, and certainly Robert would not accept by himself or on King Crimson's behalf, because he doesn't regard King Crimson as his band. It's a band.
Right.
And so if they put King Crimson in the Hall of Fame, are they putting the first band in the Hall of Fame? Is it Michael Giles or is it Bill Bruford? In a sense, probably more so than any other band I can think of that's had a definitive album. It's an unusual band, I suppose, in that it's had definitive albums with very varied groups of people. So right. There is, in a sense, I suppose, as you will discover if you see the fans arguing online, there isn't a definitive lineup of King Crimson. Yeah, some people will argue 1969, that's the definitive lineup, and then some other people argue, no, it's John Wetton in 1973, that's the or it's Adrian Ballou and Tony and Bill Bruford in 1981. So,
well, but Frank Zappa's in there, and he's had yes, many iterations.
Yes, except that was Frank Zappa. That's the essential difference. Uh-huh. You see, so Frank Zappa were Frank Zappa's bands. Whereas King Crimson is not Robert Fripp's band.
Well, because what I'm getting at is, yeah. Is it record corporations? Why isn't King Crimson recognized as a key band?
So why it hasn't been asked is a different question. So there are two halves of that question. The why it hasn't been asked may or may not be politics of record labels. Obviously, we're not with a major record label, and recently we were quoted, I think, as having an anti-music industry stance, I think was the exact wording that was put out in a recent, not by us, I think the music industry didn't like it, because, oh, this is a band with an anti-music industry stance, which is...
I think that's a good thing.
Which is probably true. So why King Crimson hasn't been asked is one side of the question, but I said there is a complexity in that... King Crimson is a multi-headed beast, and so unless they were cunning enough to word it in a way that the band found acceptable, it is odd, because I said, unlike Frank Zappa, who can accept on all...
Yeah, but I don't see why you can't just bring Bruford in and all the people that are alive.
But the question is, who are they honouring? That's, in other words, it comes back to the question of what the committee were to ask.
Yeah, I mean, they've been influential the whole period, though.
Yes. So, but I think there is a... So it's a two-sided question. But the simple answer is we've never been asked, so the question has never become mattered. Yeah.
All right, so Discipline Global Mobile is what... And why you are considered... Yes. You know, that is against the record industry in some ways. Yeah. And it was Fripp's response to not getting paid by the record industry.
Yes, so it's... when we first started, we wanted to set up an ethical, artist-led, artist-friendly record label. That's, you know, our business aims are proudly put on the website, and the principal aim of the, or one of the aims of the label, is to bring music into the world, which otherwise would be unlikely to do so. And so therefore... The problem, I think, with the music business is that most of the music business is business and then music. I don't wish to categorize all business, but I mean, that's, you know, they are businesses. Certainly the ones with the multinationals with shareholders like Universal, they're businesses with shareholders.
Mm.
And the shareholders want to make money. So actually, I'm not criticizing them for this, but by definition, therefore, in effect, they are businesses that trade in music. That is what they do. Whereas that isn't what we do. We we make music. When we have a project, we do follow a project that we believe is musically valid. And our experience over the years is that if you do something that is musically valid, the world will support you. It may not make you super rich, but generally, you know, if you do something that is musically valid, enough fans will buy it that you can continue to survive. And probably the best example that I can give you is the album Thrack Attack. I don't know if you know that album. It's an improvised album, 1996. And when we were having a meeting with our accountant, the year that Thrack Attack came out and had done reasonably well, it was obviously sold enough that we'd recoup the costs, and the band had all earned royalties from it. And our accountant looked at me and said, "What market research did you do before putting out the album Thrack Attack?" And we laughed and we said, "Well, actually, Robert and I sat together one evening and had a bright idea of thought, wouldn't it be fun just to take all the improvisations from Thrack and put them together into one album?" That is our market research. That was our market research. Uh-huh. So you make an album, you follow the muse, you do what you believe to be musically right, and you let the business take care of itself. So it's, in a sense, therefore, it's an upside down.
Well, but the costs have come down. You don't have to have a record press now, and now you can just do digital files. You only need 100,000 sales now instead of millions of sales.
Well, actually, in our case, bizarrely, our physical sales are rising and have been for a while. So in fact, we were late entries to the mainstream digital world. We were late entries, so because we had rising, we've had rising physical sales for a long while now, and I think that if you make beautiful things and you make them with love and care that people want to own, people buy them. So, for example, every year we put out a limited edition box set of an album. You know, they're usually about 10,000 of them, I think, get made, and they sell out every year. You know, so as a small record label, I looked out the other day, those box sets sell for somewhere in excess of $100, $150. So therefore, a small record label, you know, we produce a little box set every Christmas that has a turnover of $1 million. And I've long thought that, in fact, the mainstream industry, in a sense, I think, is hurried away from physical because actually it's easy for them. You know, if you own a whole huge catalog and you simply give the whole catalog to Spotify, you know, you can earn a ton of money for doing absolutely nothing at that point. I've given the catalog to Spotify, I can go on holiday, and the money will flow. Whereas and that isn't true of physical goods. So if you've got a hit single, that isn't going to keep selling forever unless you actually do something with it. Whereas if you work to look after your catalog, in effect, you find, you know, you put new value into it, you remix it, you find, you know, we find endless live performances of performance thing. So if you work at your catalog, actually, physical goods still do very, very well. And so for a long while, we were doing physical goods and downloads from our website, you know, which was great. And we were fairly slow entries to mainstream downloads and even slower entries to streaming. We now do it all, but actually, because we wanted to make sure that the hurrying into downloads didn't actually kill the physical sales.
Mm-hmm.
So we were slower into downloads, and I spoke at a conference probably early 2000s, I don't remember exactly when, about online, when everyone was in the business was looking for online business models, and we were invited, mistakenly I'd like to point out, they invited us to a conference where, you know, major labels were all there, explaining, you know, their policies for online sales and everything. And at some point or other, I think I stood up and said, "I think we have the most successful, currently the most profitable online business model of anyone in this room." And I said, "Oh, I can tell you what our business model is. Our business model is that we don't put any music online at all. What we do is we don't put it online and we wait until some major label puts it online wrongly and then we sue them. This is our business model."
I saw that in this other interview.
And they kept doing it. They kept doing it. I mean...
Well, and Spotify was guilty of this, yes, you said, too. Yes, so yeah. Spotify, I thought you guys weren't making money on Spotify.
So, but actually that, you know, that was a silly game for a while. But we genuinely didn't want to be online, but they kept on putting stuff online because they don't need the contract. But actually, now it's a mature market. Part of your responsibility as a record label, if you come back to our notion that we're not trying to put the business first, we're trying to put the music first. In honoring the music, part of your responsibility is to put the music where it can be found. You know, you need to, the music needs to be available so music lovers can find and enjoy it. And once the, you know, the streaming model and the download models became mature models and people that people needed, actually was part of our responsibility actually to make it available there so that people can find it. So that's why it is now on Spotify and on.
Well, what I like is that my father went to see Pete Fountain a long time ago, and you would go to in New Orleans and you'd go to the show and they would give you a tape of the show that you just saw. So now I can get every single show. Released every single show back into the 80s.
Yes, so
and I don't need to buy bootlegs or anything. I'd rather pay you for
them. Well, and actually we had a, Rob and I had a company in 2000. We started an internet company called Bootleg TV, proposing that all artists should do that. You know that everybody at the end of their show should, the perfect piece of merchandise would just be in the show. Give people the show they've just been to. Everybody wants it. It was too early. That was in 2000, and actually the internet wasn't developed enough. So the idea, I think the idea was right. The timing was completely wrong, or too early. But we did Bootleg TV. But yes, we've continued the same idea with DGM, and we aren't doing it with the current band. We will do after the band has stopped, but with all the archives prior to the current band, our intention is to put every single show that we have up on live so people can find it.
But what about when there's a mistake? Like, for instance, there was a show that I saw that Adrian Belew gets up and quotes the LA Weekly talking about that King Crimson is either the greatest band since the Rolling Stones or prog rock
Pond Stone.
And then Fripp goes off. Yeah. You can tell Fripp was not happy because he went off this, and you've released that. Doesn't Fripp get upset about mistakes and any artist?
I think the nature of...
I mean, it's historical, though.
The nature of King Crimson is that there are mistakes. It's partly, I mean, Robert will point out, it's actually inherent in the way the music is written that he calls it the King Crimson minefield. That, you know, although the music often appears to repeat exactly, it doesn't.
No.
So for the audience, you can go, it's repeating exactly, but for the players, it isn't repeating exactly. And part of that is that, therefore, they have to all be very, very aware and present and concentrating, or it will go wrong.
Right, but I would go see Milli Vanilli if I wanted all the shows to be the same.
And it does go wrong. So part of the joy of King Crimson is that you will get a unique experience every night, and the band will be present. Part of the risk of King Crimson is that sometimes, therefore, it will fall over the edge and there will be mistakes. And we accept that they are there. We don't want to embarrass or change the way that players play, which is why we don't put all the live shows of the current band up instantly. I don't want them to feel, oh God, I have to play very safe tonight because if I make a mistake, David's going to put it up tomorrow. So with the current band, if we did that, it would change the way they would play. But with historical bands who've already played and gone, everything is fair game. And actually, I can remember thinking back when I assembled the Great Deceiver box set in 1993 with Robert, and we did Providence. I think the first live performance on that box set is Providence. And in the piece Starless, you know, that glorious moment when the theme comes soaring back at the very end of that piece, there's a bum note by Robert completely, and that theme is not perfect. And there was never any suggestion that I should correct that theme, go and fly it in from another performance. That show is exactly as it was played. And I think in a funny way, the leaving the mistakes in shows that what you have is authentic, which is important because it also means that the wonderful improvisations you hear are also authentic. We haven't fixed it, so we haven't fixed the mistakes, but that also means that if you hear something absolutely magical happening, we didn't create that either. We didn't fix that either. It really happened exactly as we presented it.
Don't stop. Well, so now you're only representing the Vicar and King Crimson and
Robert.
And Fripp's solo stuff. So.
Yep.
Well, what I'm getting at is, are there no virtuosos now? Are there no great artists anymore?
That was purely to allow us to concentrate on what we do. So the success of DGM as a business model was that people would like to be on it as a label. So for a while, it was therefore there could have been a growth model. John Paul Jones was on there. We had the solo projects by a lot of the King Crimson members. A lot of other people were asking us if they'd like to be on the label. And I realized that the danger of that model was that I was no longer a music producer and creative. I was now getting up in the morning and running a record label, which wasn't in a sense the intention. So the
you're an artist yourself.
Yes. So therefore we decided to slim down the label to the essentials. So in effect, we made it a vehicle for the music of Robert, David, and King Crimson, because that way we can achieve a balance between between honoring that music, handling that music correctly, but also remaining musicians.
Well, anything on your site, this guy Michael Grenfell talks about J.G. Bennett, and yes, that there's a dialectic between audience and musician, and then something, a third thing comes out of that. Do we have educated audiences and educated musicians enough to create good music?
This is actually a
philosophical.
Yes, well, it's Robert's precise area. I don't wish to misquote him, but for any concert or musical event, you actually need three things. You need the musician, the audience, and the music. Those are the three things that will come together to create a true musical event. And hopefully tonight here at the Greek, that will happen, and magic will occur. It's also one of the reasons why there is a no photography thing at King Crimson concerts, because the audience is necessary, and the audience therefore needs to be paying attention to music. For that magical thing to happen, you need the musicians to be present for the music, and you need the audience to be present for the music, and then the music happens. Whereas if you allow photography, in fact, a lot of the audience is no longer actually present for the music, because the audience are actually photographers.
Yeah.
Which is a very different experience. I'm not begrudging it, but it's a different experience.
Right.
The moment you go, I'm doing this.
Yeah.
If a band plays something wonderful, I'm not actually paying attention to it anymore.
Yeah,
I'm
not
taking
a
photograph.
Yeah.
So.
Well, continuing on with the music industry, and then I'm going to wrap this up, but, is King Crimson a protest band? You've already said, is it a war band?
No,
but
I don't.
Is it an anti-corporate music band?
I don't think King Crimson is a protest band. I think King Crimson is simply open to music. So I think that Robert Fripp and I personally have an anti-music industry stance. And actually, I didn't even begin with one. In fact, we simply were trying to find a way of honouring the music, and that has led us in an alternative path to the mainstream music industry. So in a sense, I certainly didn't set out to antagonise or be different or protest against the music industry. It's simply that if you get up in the morning and you try and follow what you believe is right for the music, you realise that you're actually, you're walking over here while a lot of other people are walking over there. Whereas that isn't true of the band. So the band themselves, or in fact King Crimson, is not... King Crimson is simply open to music. So King Crimson is not like a punk band in the sense that it's not protesting anything.
Yeah, it's just that their lyrics, even Circus right now, to me, Circus is about bureaucracy.
Yes,
But musicians have been paid, and I'm going to use this analogy, since the Black Obelisk landed, like in 2001. I mean, musicians have been paid in one way or another... By the tribe, how should musicians be paid? Should they're in Ireland? They're paid. I think they're still paid by the government.
So
how should the musicians support themselves, or how should they be supported by society?
No, we've maintained that's a larger question which we have yet to address, I suppose. But I can tell you why. So our principle, firstly, is that if music is paid, the musicians have to get a fair share. So in other words, at the moment I'm setting aside the notion that music is free. So the first thing is, if music is going to be paid, the musicians have to get their fair share, which is probably where we diverge from many in the music industry. So we're saying, fine, if you're going to sell a record, the artists have to receive what we deem to be a fair royalty. And similarly with Spotify, if you're going to take, a load of money in subscription fees, the musicians have to get their fair share. So our fight, or not fight, but our stance has been that that has to be the case. I think there's a larger question. In fact, I did an interview with someone where I effectively argued against myself, I suppose. I think there is a point where you music could be free. I believe, in a funny way, I think the ownership of music is a
bit, I mean, they used to get food from the tavern.
Yes, no, I think the ownership of music is, I think, in a sense, an absurdity. In fact,
of all art.
I mean, the ownership of music, if you take music as being this pure thing that sends from the heavens and here it is an absurdity. And I, in fact, I did a blog where I wrote, I just learned to play a piece of Bach. It's beautiful. I just sat there on my fingers, I played it. And I think the notion that somebody should own that piece of music the notion that somebody owns that piece of music is bonkers. That just seems like pure music that came from heaven. I'm not denying that Bach was a genius, and it came through Bach, and so I'm very happy that his name was on there, and he's absolutely wonderful.
Right, nobody owns classical music.
But in a sense, there was a whole series of chord changes, beautiful chord changes there. But actually now, you get to the stage where somebody owns them. Hey, I wrote a piece of music that has this chord change, so I now own this chord change. And if you go and do that chord change, it's my chord change. Uh-huh. That is, I think at a basic level, that's an absurdity. So there is a point at which music is this magical thing that should exist outside of money. And you could have had an entirely alternative model. Well, there was originally, in fact, which was one where musicians were, I suppose they either had patrons or, were paid. You get some bands were supported by fans, so effectively the fans are actually supporting, they're not actually buying something. They're just supporting people because they believe in their music. So you could have alternative models.
Yeah, that's like a co-op what I'd like to see.
Yeah.
As what I was going to do with what I'm trying to get our radio station to. We would be the download site. We would be the promoter. The radio station itself would be the promoter of local bands. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then and people would come to our site to download their music. Yeah. Since I don't have to have a record press anymore.
Yeah.
So I'm going to try and wrap this up. Do you want to talk about Taylor Swift or Judy Garland? These questions I had.
I don't need that question. So go tell.
Well, Taylor Swift just released. I think you've already answered it. She just released her to get more control over her art.
Right.
So
I haven't been following. I know Taylor Swift is one of the people who does pioneer that argument. I haven't actually been following her case. But I think the ownership of if we go back to this dichotomy that I've been explaining, I'm very comfortable with the idea that the ownership of music is slightly absurd. That's entirely, I'm entirely comfortable with that. Equally well, if somebody is going to own music, it seems ridiculous that it's a record label.
Yeah, that's right.
Bluntly. And the one analogy for a record label is, because loosely, when most artists make a record, and a record label will give them an advance. If the old model, the record label will give the artist an advance, the advance will go away, the artist goes away and records it. The record label recoups the advance, but then magically the record label owns the record. So it's exactly like if you took out a mortgage on your house, you pay back the mortgage, and in the end the bank still owns the house, not you. Mm-hmm. That is, in effect, the model of the record. It's so if music has to be owned by anybody, I think it would be better that it was owned by the artist that created it.
All right, and then I'm trying to wrap this up. Judy Garland was discovered by the movie corporations, and so there's an example where a corporation probably brought us a good musician.
Yep.
And I don't know, what do you think of Ariana Grande? And now the new gal is Olivia Rodrigo.
Right.
She hasn't picked a band yet. I'm waiting to see what she's going to sound like live.
I have no problem with the fact that this is quite nuanced. In truth, I mean, because inevitably in life, there are shades of grey, and so you can go away. You can go from I don't know. I was going to say Bach, but you can go away from a sort of a purebred old fat musician over here, and right over the end, on the other end of the scale, you could get a band created by X Factor or by Disney or somebody. So there, and actually nominally, this all fits within music, and. But they aren't quite the same, because if you take the one, it would seem absurd that any corporation should have anything to do with Bach, or whoever you choose over on the left-hand field. On the right-hand field, actually, if some record company, or a TV program, X Factor is probably a good example, if some TV program effectively puts a band together, creates the the interest in the band, because it's their TV program that's effectively creating it, you can see that isn't... There's a much better argument that the corporation has actually contributed to the creation of whatever that becomes mm-hmm. than the other one. So there are.
So they deserve to recoup.
There is a. You know, it's not one size, as in always in life, it's not one size fits all answer for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right, and so you, The Vicar, you have a graphic novel.
There is a graphic novel of The Vicar. There is the. The Vicar currently has the first two Vicar Chronicles exist as a book, and they are they're probably best described as Sherlock Holmes meets Spinal Tap, or surreal tales from the underbelly of the music industry. The history of those was years ago when we were suing some record label, and we were sitting there with all these astonishing stories of corruption going through our inbox. I said to Robert, well, why has nobody written whodunits about the music industry? Because it's what, you know, it's corrupt, it has glamour, it has everything you would want in a good series of stories. And this Dorset voice from behind me in the studio said, because you haven't written them yet, David. Which I took as a challenge. So there are two Vicar Chronicles already. The third one is now finished. The first one has been changed into a graphic novel. Moderately successful. The second one is a wonderful graphic novel, and my son did the graphic novel. He was only 17 when he actually drew the first one, and he would now die in shame at the way he used to draw it. As he's moved on to be a fantastic artist, he did the second one. So yes, and the wonderful thing about The Vicar is that having created this character, which arrived the way things do, just arrived formed. Okay, there's this record producer called The Vicar who is the centre of those books. It was obvious that The Vicar should make an album. So The Vicar songbook exists. There's an album by The Vicar. And in making that album, it was wonderful. I contacted all sorts of people who were very happy, and I came and said, you know, The Vicar is making an album, would you please like to play on it or sing on it? And everybody said yes, and they were very happy to contribute to this wonderful album by this person who doesn't exist. Isn't that fabulous?
Of songs that you wrote as a child.
Yes, yes, yes.
As a young man.
Yes, so the bizarre history of the really is you ask me now if I'm talking about it, it's a number of songs, and I could never get them arranged properly. They were very good as songs in theory, but they weren't written for a band to perform, and I wasn't capable of arranging them, so they sat. And I discovered that, in a sense, the perfect partner that my 20-something-year-old self needed turned out to be the 50-year-old version of myself, because I could go back now, years later, and I don't have possibly the wonderful naivety you have when you first write songs, but I do probably now much better musical chops to be able to arrange them properly. So yes, ironically, The Vicar, in a funny way, is a partnership of me with myself.
Well, all right, last question is, how does DGM work, though? How did it work before you were just the three of you?
Yeah.
How did you, for instance, for John Paul Jones, where did the money come from to A, get studio time, and B, pay for his tour?
We were never that kind of a label. So effectively, we were, we simply were a conduit for people who already had the music. So John had the album, but if you remember, well, we still, actually, that's true, because as I started by telling you, we haven't gone out of the physical distribution business, we're still in it, actually. So,
has the money to do that.
But certainly then, this was still in the days of CD. You made an album, you now had to get it made onto CD, and you had to get it put in all the shops, you know, worldwide. And that bit we did have. So effectively, what we did was we offered people who'd made albums. So John had made the album. We offered people like that. We said, fine, you've got the album. We are, in that sense, we were watching a more old-fashioned record label. We can pay, we can pay to get this thing manufactured, distributed, and put in all the shops and pay royalties.
But that's what I mean. So somebody, because I'm trying to do this for my radio station, so somebody had to come up with some money to do that.
Yes, and where did the seed money come from? Actually, it's not. The answer is provided if you don't gamble. you don't gamble, actually, there's no, in a sense, there is no risk. So it's more complicated if you do new artists, because there is more of a gamble, there's a larger gamble involved. So in effect, if you, which is why I don't have a problem with, you know, record labels, recouping advances. So I can accept that if you take on a brand new artist, there is a risk, because, you know, 1 in 10 may succeed, the other 9 may lose money. Whereas what we were arguing is that with more mature artists, that's an absurd system, because there is no risk. As in, we could look at John Paul Jones and say, we know John Paul Jones is going to sell, say, 30,000-40,000 records, so there's no risk.
Well, I don't mean to catch you on it, but I thought you were trying to improve, you know, do experimental art.
Yes.
Experimental art was already accepted.
And we similarly did. I said we went and did Thrack Attack, and I'm thinking, well, I don't know how many copies Thrack Attack is.
That type of experiment.
I don't know what's that going to sell. Or we did albums by the California Guitar Trio, by a Rota String Quartet. So we did
not pulling somebody off the street.
Yeah, no, but actually, but most of them, in a strange way, there isn't a risk, because you don't make so many. So, I mean, with John Paul Jones, you can look at it and think, okay, you know, we know we can ship 30,000 units of this, so we can make a lot of them. We can do the press, and we can sell those. And if you're doing the California Guitar Trio, you probably start by making 2,000 of them, spreading them around the world, and then as those disappear, you make some more. So, in a sense, I think this never was as complicated as people wanted to make it. Is that, yeah?
Well, it's like Stuart Copeland is the Clark Kent, and all that stuff has disappeared because those would sell 100,000 or whatever,
yes,
like copies,
yep,
of, yep, Clark Kent.
Yep.
And so there's an established musician,
yep,
that his have gone into obscurity,
yep,
because there wasn't a label like yours.
So anyway, that's hopefully that's helpful for you.
Yeah, all right. David Singleton, producer, musician, artist, and reluctant businessman.
That's the one.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. And good luck with your label, with your radio system.
Thank you. I'm going to...
Yeah! It took hours and hours and hours. By the time I was done with it, I was so bored, I didn't know what to think. I carried on with me for days and days. Playing little games. Not looking at it for a whole day, and then looking at it to see if I still like it.
Prog rock pond scum. Hey, hold on. I think they just got a little mixed up. I think, really, if you look at this and think about it for a while, maybe King Crimson is the greatest pond scum since the Rolling Stones.
Local business, where we do all of our local grocery shopping, Sundance Natural Foods, as an underwriter for KEPW. Thank you, Sundance, for supporting quality national programming and